Hello, and welcome to episode 73 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
You don't have to be a football fan to know about Damar Hamlin. Back on January 7th, during a pivotal game against the Cincinnati Bengals, the Buffalo Bills safety suffered life-threatening cardiac arrest after what appeared to be a routine play on Monday Night Football. 2 weeks later, and much to the amazement of his doctors, Hamlin has left the hospital and, as of this recording, seems to be taking positive steps in his recovery. But this incident, which was seen by millions as it happened on TV and countless more people in the days afterward, has again prompted people to question the violence around America's most popular and most profitable sport. Rick, has this incident, along with other well-documented cases of long-lasting effects of football players who get continued blows to the head, made you think differently about football?
It's been interesting because, of course, I was watching the game when it happened, and I was shocked. I think, like many fans, we just aren't used to seeing that kind of serious injury. We're used to seeing injuries on the field, but not life-threatening ones. So that was shocking. But in the days following, there were so many pieces writing, you know, talking about how football is way too violent and how we have to do something to curb it, and even some pieces saying fans shouldn't watch football anymore. And what it did is caused me to think that why do so many people engage in fairly risky kinds of activities and sports? I mean, football certainly is a dangerous sport, but it's nowhere near the top of the kinds of dangers posed by many other activities that people don't even get paid for, you know, things like base jumping and mountaineering and free solo climbing. I mean, many people engage in these kinds of activities that are very risky. Even things like backcountry skiing with the potential for avalanches and things. There's people that die every year. And it's caused me to think, like, why do human beings participate in activities like this that are very risky when we could live lives that are much safer and relatively free of risk?
And you bring up a good point because, you know, where I initially thought when this came up is, well, a couple of things. I first should say I was not watching the game like you were on TV, but I heard about it, within the half hour. I mean, it hit the national news really quickly. And I was thinking about other dangerous jobs, but you're pointing out, and I think rightly so, is other things that people choose to put themselves in danger. I mean, you know, if you look at the dangerous jobs list, I don't have the list top to bottom in front of me, but farming is always near the top of that list. We need farmers for reasons we all understand. We don't necessarily need football players, but this is something that every football player who's a professional was a football player because they hopefully enjoy playing football. And they started that young and did it as an amateur and likely went to college. And so it is, I guess, a little different than somebody, or is it different, I guess, than somebody who chooses a job that has an inherent danger in it as well?
I don't think it is different from those jobs. I mean, one of the things you could say that, say, logging, mining, farming, even commercial fishing, in some ways they supply something necessary for the economy. But so many people go into those jobs because they like it, they're drawn to it, and they do it really well. And you know, football is like that. Even though, you know, there's many more people would willingly put their bodies at risk playing football than are ever given the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, I mean, if for every person who chooses not to play at whatever level, there are hundreds of people standing in line to take that person's job, and, well, not hundreds, but at least a dozen who might be close to qualified.
Yeah, and you know, and I've seen football players who are now in, say, in their 70s, who their they're clearly suffering. They've got arthritic knees and ankles, and you know it's hard for them to move about, and you know, and they're managing chronic pain. But you know, I had a good friend who worked as a mason for many years. By the time he was in his mid-40s, he could hardly walk. His knees and his back were in such terrible shape from working on his hands and knees so much and carrying a lot of heavy weight. I mean, roofers are another example.
Yeah.
People that have, you know, a lot of serious injuries and a lot of death in that. You would think from many people's opinions that have been written over the past couple of weeks about Damar Hamlin and the extent of injuries that football players are somehow being exploited. And yet we have no evidence that they're being coerced or manipulated or deceived. One of the issues with the chronic brain injuries, I mean, there was some question, was NFL hiding some of that data?
Yeah, 20 years ago, I think you could go into be a professional football player and not know the full scope of risk you were facing. I think those days are thankfully gone, right?
Yeah, and in fact, you know, when you look at the history of the sport, it's actually gotten much safer. We have many more people playing football. The players are getting faster and heavier and stronger. I mean, the speed of the impacts and so forth, but the equipment has also progressed a great deal. My dad, for example, played high school football in the days of leather helmets and no face masks, and he had a crooked nose. He used to joke about how he'd play it every week. His nose would be bent a different direction. I mean, but the rate of serious injury and death in those years when we had very minimal equipment was really high.
And there was even a story, and we'll certainly link to it in the show notes, but it was a column by a gentleman named Randall Balmer, and it was titled, "What Makes Americans So Crazy About Football?" And his kind of point in that is that football is too violent and actually has sort of a militaristic history to it. And he talks a little bit about how it evolved from rugby into football. And as someone who doesn't follow football ridiculously closely, I found that part interesting. But I don't necessarily agree with his premise that we sort of have militarized the sport in such a way that it makes it so unsafe, because in his column, he does point out some of the exact same things you did in the early days. It was ridiculously dangerous. And in fact, back in when President Theodore Roosevelt was in office, and I don't think anybody who knows Theodore Roosevelt thinks of him as a gentle sort of fella, brought together representatives from Princeton, Yale, and Harvard, which were some of the leading football schools at the time, and said they needed to fix their sport because it was too violent. And it sounds like they did. And it sounds like there have been, like you said, equipment changes, and I think also rule changes but I think that's where I want to pause for a second, because we're talking about the NFL because of the Hamlin injury, but I think some of this could be overlaid with D1 football, is you really have to balance the safety of your players, because that is the product you're putting on the field. And I don't think the NFL or anybody thinks what happened to Hamlin helps the game. It absolutely does not help the game. But then again, I don't think you would have it would not be the most popular sport in America if you changed the rules and made it flag football. So there is sort of that appeal to this, I guess, the violent part of it. So I think that people are attracted to the violence as long as it's not too violent. Does that seem to ring true to you?
I think it's a mistake to say that people are attracted to the violence of the game. There probably are some, but I think people are attracted to the skill and the speed and the force. I mean, it's a very physically forceful game, and so these are contests of strength. And so you have, a lot of the game is determined by the offensive and defensive lines, and there's both. You know, there's skill and strength being used there, and we tend to use the word violence whenever we're seeing people kind of fighting each other.
Yeah.
This is, in a way, kind of a controlled fighting, right? But, you know, I think the word violence might be misplaced here, because it's, you can see every year there's rule changes that are made to try to reduce the extent of serious injury. And so,
and I'm guessing sometimes those are controversial changes, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's some have said, you know, like, there's hardly any way in which a defensive player can sack the quarterback anymore, because if you hit them low, you get flagged for personal foul. If you hit them high, you get flagged for going after the head. But if you hit them in the middle and then drive them into the ground, then that's a personal foul also. And so anything but, you know, giving them a hug and holding them in place seems to be sometimes a personal foul. But, I mean, this is what the game is moving towards. And I like it. I mean, I like the fact that the NFL is continually trying to find ways to keep the, I would say, the what makes the game really interesting and compelling, while also trying to do their best to protect players.
And I'll try to say this without making it sound too cynical. But you said you were watching the game on that Monday night, and millions of other Americans were watching that game. And I was reading some of the reporting afterward that was focused on the coverage that ABC Sports did, and then I think ESPN took over at some point. And everything I read was pretty complimentary of how those networks handled this in what was a very difficult time. And I read somewhere, and you can correct me if this is not right, but because the director in the truck was not really sure what to show at this point, because you're not going to show the injury or him collapsing again and again and again. No one wants to see that. But there were still players on both sides of the field, I believe, who are still out there and being very emotional. And I think there were lots of shots of the fans who were obviously concerned and emotional. And it did bring this emotion into the living rooms of people across this country. And I'll tell you, from working at a national news organization, every step along the way of his, you know, recovery, and almost all those steps were for the good, people were really interested in that. And people were really interested in this player's prognosis. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, in the last playoff game, of course, he wasn't able to play, but he was able to go to the stadium and root on his team because he was out of the hospital. All that's terrific. But is the very nature that process, that all of this from the moment he collapsed on the field to seeing pictures of him in the hospital room to showing him being in some way reunited with his teammates, is it that such a easy emotional hook that you have these other people who put themselves at risk, whether it's a roofer or a farmer or some other person in some other profession that would never be that focused on TV and in the media? Is that okay? I mean, I guess from an ethical standpoint, we can't care about every single person suffering in this world, but we saw something happen on our TVs and we have an interest in this young man. That's probably okay, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It's because football, in a way, has become symbolic, and it's more than just a game. In a way, it stands for something. We live in a society in which our lives are really protected from most harms, most risks. I mean, we drive in cars with seat belts and crumple zones and airbags. On roads that are designed to reduce accidents to the greatest extent possible. They're replacing traffic lights with roundabouts because, you know, we have fewer injuries that way. And then we walk into an office building with HEPA filters and ergonomic office chairs to protect back injury. I mean, we just live in these incredibly safe environments. And then we watch a game that is deliberately kind of forceful and puts people at risk for injury. And in a way, it reminds, especially those of us who live in these really safe environments, that like the world is dangerous. For most of human history, it has been. And for many people, it still is. And we named like some of the jobs where you just by virtue of doing the job, you're putting your life at risk. 100,000 commercial fishermen died last year. I mean, it's amazing how many people die to supply seafood, you know, to our tables. Yeah, it's symbolic. I mean, and I can't help but think, like, here we have this moment of reverence, which I thought it was entirely appropriate. More than a moment, it was, you know, a couple hours where the networks did not know what to do.
And the NFL didn't know what to do.
NFL didn't know what to do. Sean McDermott, the head coach of the Bills, by the way, was really emerged as the leaders of the whole situation. I don't think it seemed to me like the officials weren't sure what to do at that point, and Sean McDermott seemed to tell them, we can't continue playing. We're going into the locker room. And like he kind of took charge, and mainly by talking to the players, like he really involved them in the decision-making. So he's certainly to be praised for that. We also had announcers, you know, that they did not want to speculate on what had happened to Damar Hamlin. And at the time, there was a certain period of time, I don't think people knew whether he was even alive. They knew that CPR had been administered for a long time, and they had done it twice. You know, for most people, without some really expert care, that's not a very good prognosis. And so the analysts did not want to speculate at all. They didn't want to talk about what they thought might have happened to him or anything like that. They just said, we are praying for Damar Hamlin and for his family, and that's all we can say. And I thought it was quite moving. And in a way, I mean, this is a proper human response when somebody you care for, even care for remotely, you know, just is in serious danger. This is what we do. And I think in a way it kind of stands in for all those people that we don't know, that we don't hear about, but in a way that are part of the human family.
It was interesting. Well, I guess I want to ask, let's go this way first. You know, your kids are adults now and are not going to make a career turn into football at this point in their lives. But did you and your wife have conversations just between the two of you or with your kids about football? Is that something your sons ever expressed interest in? And if they were really interested, would you have tried to turn their attention to something else?
We had two children. One of them was really into bowling, and so we never had to have too many discussions about the injury risk posed by bowling. I suppose there's some injury risk.
A strained thumb, I suppose.
Yeah, or dropping the ball on your toe.
Right.
But the other child, once he got into middle school, wanted to play football. And we did have some discussion about that because that was about the time we were starting to get information about CTEs and these kinds of dangers. And
that's the brain condition which hit after hit after hit can sort of stack on top of each other and lead to significant problems down the road.
Yeah, and one of the troubling things is nobody really knows. Like, are concussions that occur when you're younger, are they worse? As the brain is developing, did they pose a greater threat for developing dementia later in life? And how many, and how severe should they be, and what should be done to protect children from this? But we talked with him, and he really wanted to play. We talked about the dangers and so forth, and he ended up having two concussions, one in middle school and one in high school. And as parents, we were both concerned, but we were impressed with how the coaches dealt with it. You know, taking him out of the game right away as soon as they saw any evidence that there might have been some impact, and keeping him out for the following practices and the next couple of games. It's a concern, but he's off doing other things that are in some ways even more risky now, mountain biking and things like that. I mean, in some ways you have to say, look, children have to be able to learn how to manage risk. And there are certain limits that we would place as parents, but I don't think I'd want to place the limit there. I have enough confidence in the, at this point in the coaches and, I also want to be in the stands and keeping an eye on him. But That's a difficult question. You know, like it's easier for me. I find it easier to say I'm going to put myself at risk than to allow, you know, somebody that I love be exposed to that same level of risk.
There was a story, and this is one of the, we've mentioned a few stories, and we'll certainly link to all of them in the show notes, but Axios had a piece, like a lot of news organizations, in the days after the collapse of Damar Hamlin, and it was interesting and talked about, and you sort of touched on this a few minutes ago, but talked about the how mental health is playing a larger role in, well, in this case, the NFL, but I bet it's probably in all pro sports. There used to be these stoic players who never showed any emotion, especially about something that was at a winning touchdown or a game, go-ahead home run. And certainly emotion was on display on that field in the minutes and even hours after Hamlin was taken off the field. I think that can only be a good thing, right? I think not only one, because it's healthier for those athletes to have a way to process that uncertainty and that grief in the moment. But I also would say that it's good modeling for the millions watching that moment live and not sure how to react themselves and realize that, you know, they don't necessarily, that even these apparently real tough, strong men have emotions too.
Yeah, I think it's important, especially important for, I think, young men to see that modeled. One of the great, I think, the great things about a team sport like football, where it's really hard, it's really demanding, the preparation for it, but then the games, they push people to their limits of both endurance and ability, and the affection that develops among teammates, especially when there's a really highly functioning teams, is quite profound. And so the ability to show that affection, that level of concern, I think is quite important. And to know that this is not only acceptable, it's in some ways one of the really great things about the sport is the really deep friendships that can develop.
And this is different, though. I mean, things like this, maybe not exactly like this, but there were certainly serious injuries in many sports. And I just part of me thinks, though, that 30 years ago, to pick a number, that players would not have been so open about their emotional reaction to this as they were this time. And maybe I'm wrong, but I just get the sense that this sort of what it is to be a strong male macho athlete is thankfully different than what it was 25, 30 years ago.
That could be. Now, I'm reluctant to use the word mental health to talk about any time we're like showing emotion falls into the healthy mental functioning side of life. And I was also kind of disappointed. You know, you see the word stoicism used. It was used in this article as an example of like of restraining all emotions. Where is actually, you know, stoicism, I think, is in some ways necessary for good mental health, for proper mental functioning. Like one of the things that Epictetus, one of the most famous Stoics, said is that you should remind yourself of death and illness and disability every day. Put these things before your mind. And the reason is we shouldn't live with blinders on about, you know, the reality of things that might afflict us or might afflict our loved ones. We should always move about in the world with a real sense of our vulnerabilities so that they don't overwhelm us, right? And I think in some ways that's, we're getting better as a society of doing that, because I mean, let me step back a minute. We live in a world where we hide the evidence of death, and we hide the evidence, I think, of a lot of pain and suffering. We don't like to show it on our television programs. Even things like funerals, the existence of mourning for loved ones and so forth, is something that we do quickly and we get through it and we get rid of it. Whereas, you know, the presence of death for most of human history has been always there, right? And I would say that that's probably had more to do with many of our struggles with mental health over the last several years, is the ways in which we push pain and injury and death aside and don't acknowledge their real presence in the world. And so the more we bring them out into the open, the better off we are. Now, is that a matter of showing more emotion? I don't know if it's that so much as it's just a kind of acknowledgement of the real like presence of pain and suffering. And it's hard to learn as an individual growing up in the world. It's hard to learn how to navigate through pain and suffering.
Before we close on this topic, I want to take it in kind of a strange but different place. But what you just said reminded me of something I read a few weeks ago. And it was, a short piece of writing by a funeral home director who I follow on Facebook. And obviously, he and many of his colleagues spend lots of times going to hospitals and picking up bodies of people who have died at the hospital and bringing it to their facility. And he said there is just starting to be a change, but it's a very slow one. But almost every time when he goes to the hospitals in whatever area this gentleman lives, they always have the, I guess, loading dock for him in the back corner of the hospital by the dumpster. And he just thinks that just sends the entire wrong message, that we should not be hiding this and we should not be shielding other people from it. And I don't know if you necessarily want the stretcher with the body bag on it going out the front door, but I did see in the comments to his Facebook post a number of people chimed in saying they work at nursing homes. And it is actually becoming more common for, instead of, it used to be, oh, you know, so-and-so died in the room on the corner, all the residents had to go inside their room and close their doors when they brought the body out. And I guess now there is a switch to find a way for the people who are, you know, let's face it, oftentimes very elderly and staring death in the face, and to acknowledge and celebrate the person whose life has been lost and acknowledge that in some way and not make them stay inside a closed room.
Well, I'm glad to hear that there is kind of a shift, and I hope it keeps going, because I think it's absolutely essential for our well-being to acknowledge that, our well-being as individuals and as a society. In medieval painting, and I would say even, you know, after the medieval period, there was a number of paintings that would be called memento mori, reminders of death. So you'd have paintings of with a skull, and sometimes you'd have a young woman holding a skull in her hand and looking at it, and it's showing the difference between, you know, like healthy, vibrant youth but then the presence of death is just around the corner. And the Dutch still life artists would have these paintings of flowers, but there would be a few flowers that were decayed or in the process of decay, or there might be insects that were eating the leaves of the flowers. And these are reminders of like how fleeting life is. And even if our lives are vibrant and functioning really well right now, death is waiting for us. And I think it's an important reminder. It reminds us like not to take life for granted. And it reminds us to be more compassionate with one another. And so that in some way, though fortunately, Damar Hamlin survived. And frankly, I was surprised, but really grateful that he did. I didn't think the prospects looked good for him that evening.
But it's often the people who, like him, that survive, who face that, who kind of go to the precipice, oftentimes, not always, come away with that newfound perspective that they lacked before and many of us lack even now.
Yeah, which is why it's important to talk about it, right? So that we regain that perspective. This has been an interesting week, or well, I would say about 2 weeks now since the incident. I don't think that we're going to see real significant changes in the NFL because of that. I think that we'll continue to see just kind of incremental changes in the rules and so forth. But if judging from what's going on in the playoffs and so forth, I don't think it's going to affect audience numbers or anything else. And so this may be a moment for some reflection, but I don't foresee any big changes happening as a result.
We end each show by asking an ethical dilemma. And Rick, here's my question for you. And I'm going to make sure I put a big, bold headline in front of this, that this is extremely hypothetical. But I think it's still an interesting, it'll be interesting to hear what you have to say. You, Professor Rick Kite, had the disgraced congressman and serial liar George Santos as a student for one semester 10 years ago. He seemed to you like a dishonest guy then, and you have a few amusing stories to tell that prove that point. A national news organization contacts you. How much, if anything, do you say?
Professors have an obligation not to disclose anything about students' grades. I mean, we can't even disclose grades to their parents unless the students have given permission. So anything that's on their transcript, on their record, we can't disclose any of that. Beyond that, as far as I know, there's no legal requirements of confidentiality for me to tell a story about something that a student did in one of my classes.
Especially if it wasn't predicated as something they were telling you in confidence.
Right, yeah. So if it's something that anybody else could see, I'm just saying that. So I don't think there's any legal obligation, as far as I know, for confidentiality and kind of routine behaviors. Still, I don't think I would share anything. And I think I wouldn't share anything because one of the things that I try to do in a classroom is create an environment of trust where we can speak openly to one another. We can share thoughts and we can even share ideas that we're trying out, that we don't want to be held out, you know, out of context of the class. You know, we wouldn't want to be held responsible for them. We might not want to share those ideas, say, on Facebook or Twitter or something like that. But we can talk about them in class. And that allows a kind of freedom that learning requires, especially in an ethics class where we're taking positions on difficult issues. Now, this is a long answer, I understand. But so say that if I had had somebody like George Santos and he had done some things that were kind of amusing or revealing about his character, something like that, I think the reason I wouldn't say anything to a national news outlet, I would not want to give any of my current or future students the idea that I would reveal stories about them. I think it could have a kind of a chilling effect on those classroom discussions. And so that's why I probably would say no thank you to that.
Let's just twist the question a little bit. And again, this is already a hypothetical, so I'll make it, we can do that. But let's say he was actually a really good student, and you saw nothing about him that would lead you to believe this, and your memory of him was of a, you know, good, responsible, young member of the campus community, and you were shocked that 10 years later he is running this political life built on lies. Would that change anything?
Yes, I think it would. I wouldn't have any hesitance in saying good things.
Okay.
Right, about a former student. But I wouldn't want to say anything that I regarded as kind of shameful or embarrassing.
And would you, and I guess to close this topic, would you though, so you're not going to talk to NBC News or CBS News or, you know, insert national news organization and share that, but if you and you know a colleague of yours who was there 10 years ago also had that also had in this hypothetical, George Santos as a classmate or as a student, rather, would you pull that person aside and say, hey, Helen, I know you used to, we both had him as a student. What was your impression? I mean, would those be a kind of closed door conversations that you would be okay with having?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So there'd be different standards of reporting something to the media and having a discussion with colleagues where we both remembered having the student, or even maybe with other colleagues who didn't have him as a student, but, you know, we're talking, like, because faculty members do this all the time. We share stories about students yeah. and our experiences teaching and so forth that are not for public consumption.
And right? then if Helen decided to go on CBS News and tell her story, would you think, and again, it wasn't necessarily positive, would that make you feel differently about Helen?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that would be appropriate. Now, there is an exception to all of this.
Okay.
Let's say George Santos had some of the lies he had told had to do with him being a student at my college.
Oh, yeah, that he was, yeah, okay.
That he had done certain things or taken certain classes, and I knew those things to be false.
Okay.
I would have no problem in saying, no, that's false.
Or that right. he was some, like, that he got a, because you offer doctorates at your college. He had a doctorate in that from your college. You would have no, I mean, whether that would be you or a spokesperson for the college or the university would have no problem saying, absolutely, that's not true.
Right, yeah. Or saying like, yeah, he was never a student in any of my doctoral courses.
Yeah.
You know, like that sort of thing. You know, so I wouldn't want to betray something that I regarded as a confidence, but I would have no problem with correcting the record if the false record had been put out by that individual, and I was just correcting that. So that would be the one exception I would make.
So I'm going to draw one last thread from this. This is a broader question. Is 10, you know, we'll set George Santos aside now. But, you know, if I just went back 10 years and looked at your class log and just at random picked a student out of your class and said, tell me everything you know about insert name here. How confident are you that, I just don't know, because I mean, you have a lot of students come through. I mean, how confident are you that 10 years ago that just some random student would have left enough of an impression on you that you would have a memory to or a story to tell?
Oh, yeah, that's really interesting. You know, most of the students that I have for just one class, I do not remember them very well. If I have them for two, I tend to remember them much more. And some students I'll have for three or four classes, I remember them very well. And so it's all a matter, for me, it's a matter of time. And yeah. I'm the other thing is I'm not very good at remembering their names after a few years. I have colleagues who seem to remember every student's name, and I don't. After the year, about a year is over, I have a hard time remembering the names, but I remember their faces, and I'll remember things about them. But I have students that I had 30 years ago that I remember really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I have students that were in my class last year that I don't remember much at all. And all the it all depends on the level of interaction.
Well, I promise to not ask you either of those set of names, but if George Santos does ever enroll at your college, please, please let me know.
I'll do that.
And as a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Chris Lay is Lee's podcast operation manager. Please subscribe to The Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.